On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail. But what about the promise to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You know, it's 40 years ago this year that Second City Television started. As a kid growing up in Detroit, I got to see many of those episodes in a weird way on what used to be the old Global Network. And now a show that I think actually feels like it's set in a small town with a bunch of quirky, unusual characters. It definitely has its lineage in Second City Television. The show is, and I love saying this title on public radio, Schitt's Creek. Its creators and the stars, Eugene Levy and Dan Levy, sitting across from me. And the stars, guys, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you for having the courage just to say Schitt's Creek without too much preamble.
Yeah, we'll be doing a lot of that during the show. But it actually does remind me almost it could be, basically be a Melonville kind of a setting for the show, can't it?
I think it's very close to Melonville. I think the thing that really makes it very close is the fact that Melonville wasn't really set anywhere. You didn't know where it was. It was just the town of Melonville. And you heard about a few neighboring towns as well. And Schitt's Creek is the same way. We don't set it in any specific location or any specific country or any, you know, it's just Melonville. And the only other town you hear about is Elmdale, the bigger town. And so it's its own world, as was Melonville and SCTV.
Which I think really separates it from standard sitcom, that does feel like its own place. And that sense of place is really key to the conception of the show, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah, I think by not knowing where you are, it sort of focuses, I think, the audience. There's a very sort of isolated feeling when you don't know what's around you. And narratively speaking, I think that was a really important thing for us because you, as an audience member, you're really focused in on what's happening without worrying about the frills of, you know, where they are and, you know, all of that sort of stuff that really wasn't ultimately necessary in the storytelling for us.
But talk about how the show's idea came to you guys.
I had been playing around very early on with the idea, now that we collectively have this awareness of how wealthy people live via reality television, and it's an awareness I think that we've never really had before. I think there was like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous like a long time ago.
Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
That, yeah, exactly. Suddenly we're back. That I think informed people sort of you know, lavish lifestyles. But now it's like it's everywhere. It's on Instagram. It's, you know, on our television screens. So playing on that sort of awareness, I thought, what would it look like if one of these families were to have lost everything? And what would that mean to the family without, you know, the bandage of money? What would that look like?
So that was in the very beginning, I guess. The fact is, the sensibility that Dan had in mind for this was this kind of the same sensibility that Chris and I had in our movies, which is a sensibility that I've had. Christopher Guest, yes, which is keep everything grounded, keep everything real, and let the comedy come through characters, really character driven, as pretty much as everything I've been doing in my career, going back to SCTV, all character driven. And as broad as some of those characters were, we never stepped outside of the box to get a laugh from those characters. It all came from within. So this show had to be, you know, it really was kind of a character-driven show. We knew that. And the idea of a family losing money was where we started, and then it kind of developed into what Schitt's Creek is. The idea of them buying a town was an article that Dan came in with at one point.
I stumbled onto some kind of like collection of stories about how people have lost their money.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of them was the Kim Basinger story of having bought the town and it didn't financially pan out the way she had hoped, unfortunately. And that really twigged us into that world of what happens if this family had actually bought a town on a whim.
Just the idea of a family
because
being
the
so...
name was silly.
Yes.
And then, you know, next thing you know, this is the only thing they're able to keep once the government sort of takes all their stuff.
The idea that they had to end up living in the town they bought as a joke was really a linchpin factor, you know, for me. It really tied the whole thing together and made Schitt's Creek the most appropriate title for the show.
What was that pitch like to the CBC when you threw that title at them?
They were unbelievably receptive to the pilot presentation that that they had seen. And CBC was also looking to rebrand themselves, you know, going more cable in their sensibility for their comedy. So we were kind of in a right place at the right time.
That said,
situation.
There was, you know,
a little bit
the
of
suggestion
friction.
Of like, what about up a creek? What about without a paddle? They were met with just some blank stares. And fortunately, we were able to, you know.
Well, we said that it had to be Schitt's Creek. There's no, we can't play around with that title. And then the fact that it was an actual name was our big selling point. You know, I said, well, if you had a news show and you've got a guy you're interviewing and his name was Reginald Schitt and it's spelled S-C-H-I-T-T, and there are, we found this name in phone books all over the place.
Was that the beginning of the putting this together, is finding the actual name.
We had to justify and validate the fact that this name is real.
That it's not so much jokey-jokey, that it's actually a name. There are people with this name.
We have to be inclusive. It's 2016.
It's public radio, so we talk about inclusiveness here.
Would you super the name on a news show if you were interviewing somebody and that was his last name? They said, well, we would. So I get the point.
It's of Irish descent, if people are interested.
See, this show is all about information.
In fact, there is a Schitt's Creek in Ireland.
We found out after the fact.
Is this going to be the third season opener? You go back to the family name?
It's going to be the spinoff. Co-pro with the BBC.
But it's also, too, the show is so well cast. I mean, you've got Chris Elliott, you've got John Hempel, a former SETV person, and Robin Duke, and dear God, Catherine O'Hara. Obviously, you're talking about making the show feel grounded. If you cast actors rather than people going to do shtick, that makes the show real, doesn't it?
That we have an amazing cast, yeah. And somebody like Catherine is just you can't do – it's hard to duplicate that kind of casting because Catherine brings so much, you know, to the dance floor, so to speak, you know, comedically speaking, creatively speaking. Same with John Hempel that I've worked with for years. And the cast generally, not – forgetting this young man sitting beside me who just kind of just exploded out of the box on this show, just doing work that is, you would think he'd been doing it for years and years and years, but it just brilliant stuff. And you know, and a great, and Annie Murphy playing my daughter. It's her first, I believe her first professional job, and she's incredible. And Emily Hampshire playing Stevie. We have a cast that kind of fits the bill, the character-driven show, the idea that this show was going to be carried by characters where the audience had to be involved in the characters, and if that wasn't going to happen, then we don't have a show in this cast, really.
And I also think, too, like, you know, from the beginning, our approach was to treat it like a drama. This is a tragedy, ultimately. This is what this family has gone through is a very tragic thing. And if you play that, you know, as my dad was saying, as a real thing. That's, I think, how we were able to engage the audience and win them over, because this family on paper is not what I would call likable, but their circumstance you feel for. And that's because we treated it real. I think if you had gone with, you know, a broader approach to the comedy, you would have removed the reality. And in that case, I don't think it would have worked. So even in terms of the directors we hired, they're all from drama backgrounds. And, you know, there was a real concerted effort to keep this real and not, you know, let it loose in the comedy world. Don't push the comedy too hard.
But it's also a family kind of getting its comeuppance because it is perhaps the most superficial family in the history of television.
Yeah. It doesn't look good on paper, this family.
No, very inept.
No, well, Dan, talk about your character, David, who goes through a really interesting transformation in the second season of the show.
Yeah. I mean, I think the great as a writer on the show, too, what's really fun to write and then to play are people who are just – is a person who has been so taken care of his whole life, which is a real thing. There are, you know, there are a lot of kids these days who have never known what it is to work or make their own money or, you know, experience trouble, real trouble and problems that can't be solved with, you know, your parents writing you a check. And exploring that world from a 30-year-old's perspective was really fascinating because I know people like this. It's scary, but it's true. And, you know, you put them in a context where they can't pay their way out of it, and you're dealing with people who have virtually no basic life skills. And that's really funny, but it's also really sad. And I think for the character of David, he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And that is, I think, what has endeared him to people, because he's just a ball of fear and anxiety and, you know, just naivety, ultimately.
It's the truth. We're talking about Schitt's Creek. My guests are the creators and stars, Eugene Levy and Dan Levy. I think what's kind of interesting, too, in the episode in the second season, it almost plays like Preston Sturges, where David helps it with a women's shop and decides to become a consultant there and just starts talking about write-off as if it's just this magic thing. And just that this conversation between the dad and son about what a write-off actually is really brilliant stuff.
It's this family that didn't really know how to relate as a family when they had money because money was the answer to every problem.
And it was the buffer, so they didn't have to talk to each other.
They didn't have to talk to each other about it. And now, I mean, the most joyous aspect of this show, you know, the richest of rags thing is, of course, what the show is about. But in actual fact, it's about this family learning to be a family now that the kids are almost like in their, you know, 30. David's 30, Alexis 28, and they're going through things that parents normally would be going through when their kids are 3, 4, and 5.
But the parents are basically, in a lot of ways, as infantile as the children.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're all stranded in a major
they're
way.
They're stranded and spoiled.
Yeah. And the write-off thing ultimately came from a conversation we had in our writer's room about what exactly write-offs are. And, you know, we have a very big, wide cross-section of ages in our room. And there were people who, you know, genuinely didn't know the specifics of what a write-off is. They submit their taxes and they do, you know, they do all that they do, but the idea of an actual write-off, and then it just got into like a whole afternoon of, well, what exactly are write-offs and why are they called write-offs? It's very misleading. And that ultimately sort of ended up being the scene that we wrote, which was quite
fun. It's also fun, too, that by the end, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a kind of a shift, and at least one of the characters seems to be growing up on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fun part, is to there's a big pendulum swing, I think, in terms of the like arc of the entire series. And for us, just season by season, you're sort of swinging that pendulum from just a place of not knowing anything to hopefully having some kind of foundation of understanding and appreciation, not only for what you have, but for what family is. And just sort of the slow swing has been a really fun thing to sort of stretch out over a season. But yeah, it's been nice to see these little moments with all of these characters where they're starting to assume responsibility for the first time. And again, it is infantile. It's like, you know, my character gets a job for the first time in his life that wasn't completely funded and endorsed by his parents and genuinely doesn't understand why it's hard. And that's, you know, that's the, I think, where a lot of the comedy comes from in the show. And it's really sort of genuine stuff.
What's that thing you were talking about? And then you were too, Eugene, where 5 degrees to the left in that conversation about business is completely tragic. I mean, just, and it also kind of shows that your character actually once upon a time was a businessman who knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Well, that is we never forget that fact, and that's a key thing for the character of Johnny, is to kind of, you know, keep going, use his skills, and really to think like the businessman that he was to get him out of this situation. I mean, somebody has to keep it together. Somebody has to put on the blinders and just say, okay, we're going to take a step-by-step approach here, like any business, and we're going to confront this problem and we're going to get out of this problem. It may take a little time, but that's the approach. And Johnny really doesn't go kind of flying off the wall the way Moira does or David. Alexis, really, of all of us, really gets by, I think, the best, because she can just lose herself in any situation and not really think about the ramifications. She's really kind of a day-to-day, you know, minute-by-minute kind of person, mainly thinking about herself and how she fits into everything. So the day always goes pretty well for her. She doesn't quite get caught up in things the way the rest of the family does. But again, it's the family interaction that is the kind of the funniest, kind of, you know, strongest part of the show for me. Every time the family gets into things where you're learning something about each other and they're learning something about each other, those are really where the big laughs are.
We'll take a break and once again say the name of the show, Schitt's Creek. This is The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm sitting across from two of the pairs of the best eyebrows in show business, Eugene Levy and Dan Levy. They're the stars of the new show on Pop here in the United States, CBC in the Great White North. The show is Schitt's Creek. Anyway, one of the things that the show really seems to work on is archetypes. I mean, these people are just almost in some ways kind of like almost like stereotypical comedy characters that you could sort of flesh out. It's almost that joke about what Gilligan's Island was. You take this kind of person and that kind of person and put them in this place and see how they fare. And I wonder, as you guys are working out the sort of the character definitions, what you're thinking about.
From where we started, this family originally, when we first started talking about the idea, I think they were originally called the Steins, and they owned a frozen food business, and you know it was a generational thing. And then that kind of disappeared, and we ended up with kind of where we are, where the dad in that scenario was more kind of a screw up. He was the brother who really was a big spender, and that's how they were losing their money. But in this scenario, he's quite a legitimate businessman and started his business, created the second largest video retail chain in North America.
And it makes sense that he'd be broke now just because there are no video chains anywhere.
Right. And that was also a better business for that fact. And David was kind of more an artisan, more
I think ultimately in terms of like the characters, particularly with the kids, I mean, to me what's – I find it scary and totally fascinating is just this culture of kids free spending their parents' money. Like, you know, you can go on any Instagram account or Facebook page and you just see these kids on vacation. They're staying at the Four Seasons. I don't know what you're doing. You're an intern at a fashion house in New York. Where is this money coming from? And I think that in terms of storytelling as a narrative was something that I just wanted to explore. So to me, to know the value of a dollar and to be able – that's like – I guess is just – a skill that some people – is it a skill? It's like a life lesson, I guess, that a lot of
– Well, it is a skill.
This generation doesn't necessarily have.
It absolutely is a skill. Yeah, and it's a life lesson. I mean, it's just a basic thing that you need to get through your life in a responsible way.
So to start off with MTV's Super Sweet 16, where all this money is being spent, and this, the idea of kids being raised on the
– expecting it.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's funny. The first time I believe we ever worked together was, speaking of the Super Sweet 16, Dan, when he was working at MTV in Canada, did a piece.
Spoof. We did sort of a spoof episode of my Super Sweet 16, but it was my 26th.
And he was taking me into a Mercedes dealership to show me the kind of car that he wanted for his 26.
And in this sort of like, yeah, it was a very sort of farcical approach. This, and ultimately I brought my dad to buy me a Mercedes and he wouldn't do it. And it was a funny little, you know, that bit that played in
very
in this
improvisational. And it was the and it was really a fun day. And that was the first time we actually worked together in front of a camera.
It's a treat. My guest was proving he's the opposite of this character. David is Dan Levy, one of the stars of Schitt's Creek. He's here with his father, Eugene Levy. He's also one of the stars and creators of the show. You said something really interesting, though, in the first part of the show, Dan, the idea of David being motivated by fear. And it's actually a show where all the characters are motivated by fear. And for Moira, it's almost like it's like a Shakespearean kind of thing. I mean, she's terrified of everything and just lashes out. And for Johnny, it's a really different kind of trying to show that he's in control. He's kind of scared all the time, too. And that just the idea of fear being this thing that because the family has nothing else but that fear.
Well, when you have everything and then you have nothing, I mean, I think that would put fear into you for a number of reasons, which is what, you know, what now? What, there's a million things you can think about that would make you very afraid. Your social scene, your social setting, your, you know, what are you actually going to do now to make money? I mean, everything was taken by the government.
And the great thing about fear is that it manifests itself in the strangest ways behaviorally. So for, you know, myself and for our writers, that's like a lovely sort of arena to play in because you get these characters doing things they would never normally do in their regular life, acting out in ways that they never normally would, and just pushing the boundaries of like self-worth, self-respect, all, you know, at the cost of you know, or at the expense of fear. So it's a really lovely sort of, you know,
arena to play to be playing in.
It's also that sort of judgment they place on themselves because they've judged themselves also by what they have rather than who and what they are. Mm-hmm. So to have those things that they have they own taken away from them mm-hmm. really does sort of amp up the fear, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think particularly for Catherine's care for the character of Moira, you know, in the second episode she reveals that at one point she, you know, used to make bread. She used to be able to start a car. She used to be able to do all these things.
Start a car without a key.
Without a key.
That's right. Yep.
And she, and she's lost that skill. And she looks at her son, who has no skills, and says, "You know, now I can understand what you and your sister are going through." The character of David has no idea what she's talking about. But I think those little hints that the character of Moira has come from a very different past than what she's, you know.
She came from the have-nots.
You know,
right?
That fear of not wanting to return to that world, I think, is what is making her particularly on edge and a little nutty.
And the fact that she's a former soap opera star and an actress in the truest sense, everything comes out in such a kind of melodramatic way because, you know, everything is kind of acted.
Everything's a scene
makes
for
it,
her.
Everything is kind of a scene.
And that weirdly is sort of passed on to the kids. I mean, for them, everything's kind of completely melodramatic too. And Johnny's almost kind of the only sane person in the house, but he's so busy trying to hold on to what's left of his self-respect that he can't even really be a grown-up.
Yeah. It takes a lot of energy for Johnny to kind of keep the lid on Moira and David and Alexis, who doesn't know what a pint is.
Well, I mean, you were talking about that episode where Moira talks about what she used to be able to do, and it comes from at one point everybody's trying to figure out who can cook in the house.
Yes.
It sounds like a short straw. Well, you can cook, can't you? Well,
no. Nobody can cook.
I mean, just this complete lack of skills.
Yeah.
And I guess I just found – I keep going back to that idea of fear because, again, it's you were saying before, this could be tragedy. And again, play 5 degrees either direction, it is that. And that's where – if you play it as if it's real, then it does feel funnier, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the key, is playing it like it's real. You know, these reality shows that Dan was talking about that, you know, were kind of, you know, created the, you know, the idea for the show – that fly-on-the-wall approach, that, of course, they have on all these reality shows, right? That's what was very important that we have in this show as well, is the audience feels like they're a fly on the wall, that this is actually happening, that everything is kind of grounded. It is character-driven. It is the key to, for me and for Dan, the key to any great comedy, if you actually can feel, honestly feel for the characters, you know. I always thought the Andy Griffith Show was one of the, if not perhaps the best comedy. There are some great comedies in the history of television.
As I said,
about
the man who played Floyd the Barber.
The Honeymoon, yes, I did. Thank you. Thanks for remembering, Elvis. Yes.
But that idea of that place, that stuff being played incredibly real.
Well, it's played so real and there are no jokes. I was watching, my wife Deb and I were watching a snippet yesterday of Mayberry, and I pointed out, I said, you know, look at these scenes. There's been 10 minutes going on here and there's not one joke. There wasn't a joke. It was just story that was coming out with the characters, and you're following right along, you know. Kind of same with the Honeymooners back in the 50s, Jackie Gleason and Audrey Meadows and Art Carney. They were, I mean, a little on the broad side for, you know, for characters, but those characters were real. They weren't so much, you know, jokes as they were playing moments. They weren't afraid to play very sensitive moments. And if you keep everything real, you can take the audience on a nice roller coaster ride. You can be funny. And you can also go to places that kind of touch an emotional button in people that might surprise them. But you've got to know that the audience is with your characters and they are invested in your characters. And that is the richest kind of comedy.
Well, I guess I was thinking, too, is interesting for me, Dan, is that these are characters, especially David, who they think that they use judgment and that will sort of like make them superior to people. They're in a place where their judgments don't mean anything. When they try to call off the residents of Schitt's Creek, it just kind of rolls right off these people.
Yeah, it's tremendously sad. It really is. I mean, I think particularly for David, like, you know, he is his mother's son, and I think he has the ego that Moira has. He's inherited that sort of sense of superiority, except, you know, he didn't have anything that he struggled through to give him that. So he just generally and genuinely believes, you know, like things should be a certain way. And when they're not, he doesn't know how to handle them. You know, even separating with selling his clothes was an ordeal. You know, going to a local church and trying to sell a $900 sweater, not realizing or understanding that no one's going to buy that sweater. You know, it's sad, ultimately. And I think that's what's really lovely to play with in that character, is someone who is just so broken, ultimately.
Was that a challenge for you? Because acting is kind of new for you in this way, isn't it?
Yeah. I came from hosting television, so it was... I'd always sort of wanted – I'd done theater growing up and I've always wanted to act. And then, you know, when you're 20 and MTV offers you a job, you take it.
Which are more all these values that we're talking about, by the way.
You take it. Yeah, exactly. you know, and so it derailed me a little bit. It was a great experience. But getting back into it, yeah, it's been a challenge, but it's been really fun.
Which, again, all these paths really seem to have led you guys to doing this show. I mean – the two different roles you've taken, it really yeah. feels that way, and that we talk about this.
Yeah, it's interesting, sort of. I'm piecing that together as we talk.
Well, we're out of time. I can't thank you guys enough for doing this. It's really been great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm sitting here with, again, the best eyebrows in show business, North Canada or the United States.
I wish you could tell that to myself in high school. That would have made me feel so much better.
Well, I'm here to help. Dan Levy, Eugene Levy, they're the stars and creators of the show On Pop. Schitt's Creek. I love saying that. A recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yore. The show is edited by Blake Fite, who's also the associate producer. Don't you know who I am? It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.